you know, what we were talking about, what was going on, and, you know, I told him, yeah, it's kind of, it's interesting because, you know, we're delving into the subject of rock critics and rock criticism, and for me, it's totally, like, kind of an interesting sort of way to approach the material, but I'm sure if there's, like, some people through my site who have kind of, you know, clicked on the MP3, I'd be really surprised if many people made it through, you know, more than a few minutes of it, because I just don't, you know, I could be wrong. I might be pleasantly surprised, and it's just because it might be kind of like, oh, what's this? I don't know what these guys are going on about. Like I have enough of the Bob context that I can dive into any Bob conversation now and just kind of, even if I don't totally know what it's about, it's like, okay, well, it's Bob, you know, I'm willing to, like, stick it out to figure out, you know, what he is going, what this is, where this is going, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Someone approaching it completely, like, out of the blue might be thinking, what does this actually have to do with rock criticism?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's hard to do. The very first chat we had, I mean, we started with, and, you know, I kind of did this a little bit deliberately, I admit, but we started the very first conversation with a long-winded thing about, Bob's long-winded thing, obviously, about Joyce and Lewis.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so it's like, and, you know, and then we go into a thing about, you know, why rock criticism is stupid, and I'm thinking, like, okay, this is... This is not, you know, the most inviting thing I don't care. I mean, I just like, you know, the direction we're going in anyway. But I'm thinking, yeah, I don't know who. I'd love to get some actual feedback on this from someone out there, you know. But it is a hard sell, as you say. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, people who tune into the Bob Buzz, you know, which you did. Well, how did you tune into the Bob Buzz?
Well, I live in Toronto, so through Dave Neufeld, I found out about his radio show at CKLN back in the late 80s, and I used to tune in, I think, almost weekly to that, so I've been aware of it since then, and I didn't have tabs on Bob for a long time through the 90s and stuff. I moved to Vancouver, and, you know, I think when I sort of speak to Dave, every few months or something, he'd kind of give me an update on what Bob was up to or something, and
mm-hmm.
then it was kind of getting back into the internet and stuff that, you know, I started getting back into it again and stuff. I mean, it's always kind of there for me because of Dave. I mean, Dave's like one of my closest friends, so
mm-hmm.
I've always kind of had that influence happening, but, you know, I've kind of come, and I mean, I do sort of come in and out of it, just, you know, the way you do that with sort of everything, I guess. So.
Mm-hmm. So Dave kind of gets Bob, and then through Dave, it stimulated your excitement?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because Dave, I think, you know, I spent a fair bit of time with Bob and stuff, too, and, you know, he talks with him on the phone all the time and stuff. So.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I used to just think the radio show was great because it was just, like, such a cool kind of call-in show with just some really, like, intriguing kind of back and forth dialogues and stuff, and I didn't, you know, I would tape a lot of his shows, actually, and I would listen to them over, which was kind of essential because, you know, I couldn't really catch it while it was happening.
Mm-hmm. Back in the early 90s?
Yeah, late 80s.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I think he was doing his CKLN show, like, I think he started in, like, 87 or something,
uh-huh.
and that was going until, like, 90 or something, or maybe 91.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, I've actually got some of that stuff on tape, but I'm pretty sure it's all on that timeline, so...
Uh-huh. Well, Bob's charisma is infectious, whether you know exactly what he's saying or not.
If you
catch his buzz, you know there's something going on there.
No, exactly. How did you connect with Bob?
Jerry Fialka had Bob on the Dave Porter Show on KPFK in Los Angeles in the mid-90s.
Right.
And I came home from work one day and I heard him on the radio and I thought, gee, this guy's got something to say. What the heck is this guy talking about?
Yeah.
So I called Jerry and he set me up with some of the Porter recordings that he'd done, and then Jerry started having excuse me kind of forums at his house where we'd call Bob and get on the phone and dialogue and probe his brain and see what he had to say. And it kind of started at Jerry's house for me.
Yeah, yeah. But you didn't know, did you know Jerry before? You just
what?
Like tuned into the show and heard it.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. What were you saying?
Did you know Jerry before, or you just tuned in and heard it on the radio, and then you
yeah. No, I didn't know Jerry.
Okay.
I called him, and he was the ombudsman for Bob Dobbs. Bob had introduced himself to Jerry, and Jerry was working for Frank Zappa at the time.
Right.
And
right.
So there were connections there to be made.
Okay.
And
how did you come to how did you come to do that whole series of interviews with Bob?
Well, let's see. I met Bob in 95, I guess, or 94, and then I moved to Portland in 2000 and had sparse phone conversations with Bob, and asked him if he wanted to talk about the Vatic Communion book. I was intrigued with his chart right from the beginning. I thought that he'd mapped something very interesting about the history of media and its effects on collective consciousness. And so, you know, Bob's ready to engage with anybody, really. And so I just asked. I said, hey, well, why don't we do your Vatic Communion book? Sure. So we did it, and you know, it's a little it was a little embarrassing for me. I never felt that I wanted to be part of a public forum with Bob, because I don't consider that I understand him that well. I'm always in the seat of the new guy who's trying to get a new insight from Bob and trying to understand his insight, which I find I think what he has to say is alive.
Scott.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm interested in what you're saying. I want you to continue to talk, but hold 1 second. I'm actually hearing my baby in the monitor.
Oh, sure.
Second, okay. I'll be about a minute.
Oh, yeah. Bob, are you there?
I was just organizing all the stuff he sent me.
Mm.
I heard the last bit. What were you? What do you think of the third Stone Cold Dead?
I liked it a lot. I'm still digesting it, you know. I mean, new information, the communication of the new is a miracle, but not impossible. So, I'm imbibing it. I want to go into it with you a little if we have some time afterwards.
That means you are listening to it because you recognize that you're not getting it totally. See, that's a good listener.
Yeah.
You know, that's good that you're not, you know, it's good you're not, well, knowing there's more there than you're getting, because he goes fast. That just before, Scott Norris, just before, wasn't it funny when he did that rant at the end and I'm just laughing my head off?
Oh, yeah.
Is that cute? Okay, Scott Woods.
Yeah.
I got some responses here.
Oh, okay.
Let me see.
Are they worth putting on the show itself?
No.
Okay.
These are more private. So, do you know who Jim Patterson is?
I definitely have heard the name, but I don't know. Dave has mentioned him, but I don't know who he is.
Yeah, he was a programmer at CKLN in the mid-80s, and he was the buyer at Record Peddler, and he was a graduate of University of Manitoba, or the other one. I don't know, there's a couple in Winnipeg. He did take a course from Croker out there in Winnipeg, so he knew Croker early, and then he went to York in the late 70s. So he's listening to our stuff. He loves the Bob and Ben stuff. He likes my stuff. He's really, he on our McLuhan list, he's making this incredible archive of photos and things that he's making and built on McLuhan stuff. So he's a great member of Club 22, so to speak. And he works for John Oswald, you know, Plunderphonic. He's the web guy and manager or something for John Oswald.
Okay.
And so, let's see. So Jim, in the late 70s at York, punk was happening. He was, I guess, watching it downtown. I was there then, too, in Toronto. And he wrote his master's on punk and maybe rock criticism.
Oh, okay.
Like, he knew that punk was, something was happening there that was significant, and he had done a lot of sociology, I guess, in his courses at Winnipeg and York. But nobody was looking at punk as something interesting or important or something in an academic context. So he wrote his paper. I think it included rock criticism because he was reading it at the time. He's an intellectual.
Right.
He was, that was like we were saying. It was sort of the most interesting intellectuality going on, you know, rock criticism.
Yeah.
And so he's got this thesis. So now he's listening to us. And he thinks, he says, Bob, this is the best stuff you've ever done. This stuff is incredible. He says, and Scott's asking really good questions, even though you don't ask that many, they're really good, right?
Excellent. Okay, good.
And so he's so amazed by it all that he says, I'm solving the issues that he still thinks about that his thesis was trying to deal with.
Wow.
You know, and he's been studying a lot of McLuhan in depth and finding good documentation over the past year, so he's getting really good at the McLuhan and understanding me, but applying it to rock is really important to him, or it's becoming important. So this is a major revelation for a lot of thinking he's done for 30 years.
Excellent.
Yeah, so he's so impressed, he wants to have a drink with you.
That's hilarious. So is he still in Toronto, you mean?
Yeah, he's always been in Toronto, you know, since the 70s.
And
he's a really smart, interesting guy, and he designed our Ionic site, howionic.com, you know, the medium.
Oh, really?
Ion. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'd love to talk to him sometime.
Yeah, because he was probably you, in the sense you read that stuff. He read it when he was young. You're a younger generation version of him. He must have been born, you know, late 19, maybe Neufeld's age, or maybe a year too older, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, he's it sounds like if he was that age during the sort of late part of the punk years, he's probably only got like 5-6 years on me, probably.
Right.
So, I was still in high school at that point, so.
So he thinks it's really tremendous how you got this out of me. Because he needed it, it turns out, in a sense that it completes his understanding of what he thought he was trying to write about, you know.
Okay.
And he got real frustrated with writing at the time and decided writing is stupid. So he stopped writing and then he got a gig on. He wanted to use newer media. So he got on CKLN. And so Jim's a very interesting guy. And so I will send him your email.
Sure. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And let's see. What else? So he's very impressed with all that we've done. And he thinks it's a really amazing explanation of Meltzer, because who he's aware of and all that, you know.
Excellent. Yeah, I know. I'd love to chat with him sometime. Hey, it's not like, you know, I don't know any people in this city or anywhere really who I can sit and gab about this stuff with for a long time. So no, that'd be awesome. I'd be more than happy to chat with him. So
yeah, he started off this whole thing telling me. He says, you know, Bob, you're working for me. And I said, oh, how's that? And he said, well, and then he explained it all. I'm completing his thinking about his thesis, you know. It's all for him, I mean, in a sense. He's the one who can understand it. So that's really good. So that is one reaction. Now, we had a reaction. Finally got Ben to listen to one of them.
Okay.
And let's see.
Lay it on me.
Okay. He writes on December 4th, Friday or so. after we did our Wednesday. And I don't know what he listened to, but I urge him to listen to, start listening to it, because I told him it's. I get to say what I can't say on his show. I don't get an opportunity to. So part of the reason, what is this? He posted, he sent a thing to me saying, hey, the new show's up. And I looked at it, and it said Ben Watson without Bob Dobbs. So I said, hey, I'm left out of the number 30 title.
Right.
And so I tell him that, and he goes, I saw that too. How did I pull that off? So he doesn't know why that happened. No idea, he says. Then he says, so I didn't ask him to comment on us, but I had told him verbally on Wednesday to listen. And so he says, listen to some of the discussion with Scott Woods. The gist of what you're saying, dash, rock as an experience irreducible to the sophomoric literary, now literary is in quotes, and I'll read the sentence again, approach of Dylanologists like Grail Marcus is spot on. So I'll read that again. The gist of what you're saying is spot on, and then he's referring to what I'm saying. Rock as an experience irreducible, in other words, can't be reducible to the sophomoric, quote, literary approach of Dylanologists like Grail Marcus. The gist of what you're saying is spot on, though as radio, it's a bit uncomfortable. Dash, you boasting you're making breakthroughs, and Scott dragging his feet and going, in quotes, in an unconvinced way. Going, in an unconvinced way. You're saying you're emphatically responding to me in a very unconvincing way, according to Ben. so I'll read that again. Though, as radio, it's a bit uncomfortable. You boasting you're making breakthroughs with Scott dragging his feet and going, in an unconvinced way. Then he says, although you feel boxed in by me, I think our dynamic is a lot more dialectical, exclamation marks.
Yeah.
But wait a minute. Don't just hold it. Also, your word for philosophy is, quote, McLuhan. He thinks when I say McLuhan, that's philosophy. Also, your word for philosophy is McLuhan. But others have, capital H-A-V, but others have thought about this stuff. Let me read that again. Also, your word for philosophy is McLuhan, but others have thought about this stuff. Then he quotes somebody named Iancu, I-A-N-C-U. I don't know who that is, I don't think.
No, I don't know either.
And then in brackets, and Hegel and Adorno, of course, you always got to bring them in. Iancu and Hegel and Adorno call it phenomenology, ... So, I wrote back to him, it's not a radio show, Ben. It's a private conversation. And then I said, and Scott is playing a passive role so he can figure out what we didn't get into when we did our History of Rock and Roll interview back in 99.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're making it available, but it's a private conversation. You wouldn't be, if you were on the radio and you were aware of an audience listening, you'd be more argumentative because the pressure's on you. You got to create the heat, right?
Yeah, and Scott Norris and I were starting to talk about that a little bit when you were off there. Like I was saying, you know, I was saying, I don't know, maybe sometimes I should be, I feel like I should be reining the conversation in a bit or something. Like, just kind of going, like I'm enjoying how it's kind of going all over the place and stuff. But yeah, when you put it in those terms, it makes sense. It's a private conversation. But yeah, if we were doing this even on CKLN or college radio or something, I'd be much more like, okay, Bob, so go on to this, so now explain this.
Yeah, you'd be propping up your identity. It's software war. Your image would be involved. You know that your image, your career, everything is there.
I'd be aware of someone else out there.
Yeah, and you'd make it a more hot conversation.
Yeah.
You know, and Ben likes that, though he doesn't like normal cliche hot. He wants... He wants intellectual hot, and he thinks we're doing it. And I agree, we're doing good dialectical, even though he gets to say more. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that I'm actually saying, referring to, that I don't get to explain. This is the sub. This is like the footnote to Bob and Ben. This is what I would have said if Ben would shut up for 5 hours and let me talk.
Right.
You know what I mean? But you brought in the Meltzer, which was really important to bring that in. That's a good way to get at it, you know, with Meltzer's writing. So I'm telling him, it's not a radio show, Ben. It's a private conversation. he might have thought it was for radio. He might even feel we're competing with him. You know what I mean? I think, because I read this to Jim, and he said, wow, he's getting defensive. And so anyways, and Scott is playing a passive role so he can figure out what we didn't get into when we did our History of Rock and Roll interview back in 99. And then I give the Earl to that, because I don't know if he knows about that. If he really was serious, he'd read that, find out what we did say, and then figure out, you know, 10 years later what sort of say. And so that's what I said to him. Then I said, if you haven't listened to part two, and then I give all the sections, then you don't know how I do my exegesis. If he heard the third show, where I'm bragging I'm the greatest rock critic, well, that's after the tremendous number two. There's a reason I'm saying it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you just suddenly hear this, you don't know the details. It's number two that's phenomenal. Because we're going into the text of Meltzer, and I'm saying stuff that's never been said that can, approaches making sense of it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I said, if you haven't listened to part two, then you don't know how I do my exegesis, and I don't know if you could call me a phenomenologist. What's crazy, this is typical of Ben, is we're doing rock criticism, he's bringing in Hegel. You think I turn people off if they're listening. Look at that shit, you know?
Yeah.
You know, your listeners would not lot. They think that's silly. So then I say, we may, after I give him the URLs to hearing all our different parts that we've done, we may get more dialectical when he gets a better grasp of what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that's what you're saying. You're actually talking about the effects preceding the causes. You're getting ready to get more dialectical, which is okay with me because we've laid out some examples and definitions. Now we can, you know, chew them up. We needed to have 3 or 4 hours to lay out what I'm talking about, what my reference is.
Right.
And then I said, we plan on doing many more. So that's what I said to him. Now, there's another guy in L.A. named Terry, and he was a friend of some McLuhanites, obscure McLuhanites in Toronto, and he makes movies in Hollywood, and he's probably, wait, you're born in mid-60s? He might be about that age. He might
oh,
be.
Oh, yeah, that's, yeah.
So, let's see. He's pretty knowledgeable in film, and he did really good. He graduated from Ryerson, and he was there at CKLN in 87 to 91, around that period, mid-80s, late-80s, when I was there. And he never heard of my show, but he didn't know anything about me. Somehow, in spring, a year and a half ago, okay, so he grew up in Toronto, but he was born in the States, but didn't live there very long, grew up in Toronto, went to Ryerson, became a top advertising guru, using a bit of McLuhanisms that he got from the Carl and Wayne, friends of Eric McLuhan, around the Coach House. And he then went to L.A., did well, he got to the sort of the top, got bored of Toronto, and he went into film in L.A. in 95. The guy who lived down the street in 95 when he moved to L.A. was Drudge. He became a friend of Drudge right when Drudge was just starting to percolate.
Okay.
And he's met a lot of people, and it overlaps. And then he brought Wayne and Carl to L.A. He brought Wayne in 2000, 2001, and to sort of get Wayne's McLuhan mime knowledge presented to him, but he didn't know Wayne. Carl had recommended him that Wayne was an alcoholic, and Wayne totally destroyed the scene there, started yelling at everybody, and was ridiculous. So that crashed Wayne and Carl's involvement with the project, but Terry went on and did it in other ways. But that was then, and that was he didn't really interact with the McLuhan scene in Toronto anymore.
Okay.
So for some reason, he found out about me a year and a half ago, and he went back to Vancouver and painted his house, his mother's place, fixed it up, like for about 6 months. And he listened to all of our Fatty Communion, you know, the 100 or more hours with me and Scott talking through the book. He listened to that and maybe a few other things he found, and he found it really amazing because I was adding to what he thought he knew about McLuhan, right?
Right.
So he emails me last spring, which will be about, you know, almost a year after he started really listening to this stuff, when he moved back to L.A. And so we started talking. And before we started talking, he says, you know, I knew someone in the McLuhan world and he describes vaguely this person. And I write back, hey, you're talking about Carl Scarf. He said he almost had a heart attack. He never thought that I'd know who Carl Scarf was. It just shocked him. So he says, man, I got to talk to you. You know Carl? Of course. And that I was able to pick it, figure it out from his, you know, vague hinting that he knew somebody. Because he wasn't sure who about me, you know. He was probably a bit nervous, paranoid. I don't know how to get involved with this maniac, even though he's pretty knowledgeable about McLuhan that Terry was interested in. So he said, we got to talk on the phone. So we started talking last summer. And it's led to a lot of interesting things. And then he didn't know any. First of all, once he started talking, he says, I'm amazed that Carl and Wayne never told me about you. You were on Ryerson Radio back then when I was there. He couldn't believe it, you know, that someone who was really pushing McLuhan and pushing past McLuhan, and these guys didn't do it. I said, well, they were scared of me or jealous or who knows what, and they didn't like me being involved with Nelson Thal. They hated Nelson Thal, blah, blah, blah. So,
right.
He was just amazed that he never knew. So anyways, as he finds out more about me, he finds out about the radio shows and C. Kellen, and he starts listening to Mike Dyer and late 80s C. Kellen show, and he's flabbergasted. He says, something that good was happening at Ryerson when I was there and in Toronto, and actually interesting callers in Toronto. He couldn't believe it. All these Canadians, man, it was totally unique. So he was really impressed with the C. Kellen stuff. So he's a total Bobite now. But so he listens to Bob and Ben. He hates Ben. He says, Ben is a fucking idiot. You know what I mean? This is a Canadian / American guy who hates the British snobbery. It's not justified, he said. Ben is like a 19th century idiot who can't take in anything new, so he won't listen to them. He listened to a lot of them, but he's fed up. He won't. He says, I don't care if Ben gives you a fucking blowjob on the fucking thing. I ain't listening to that idiot again, you know? You know, he says that, you know, if I told him that Ben is leaving England, he's moving to Maui, he wants to be my butler, like he's totally converted, he said, I still don't give a fuck about him. So he's pissed.
Yeah.
So then he started listening to us, and he likes it, but then he said this. Let's see. Now, remember, what he says, okay, was it here? So we're going to go over here. This out, there's a second thing I'm going to read to you, but the opening comments back then, he, you know, when he first started listening to it, he thought it was pretty interesting, but after a while he thought that you had no clue what I was talking about. Now he thinks he knows more McLuhan than you, so he says Scott Woods is just floundering around, he doesn't know what to say, you know, you're just drowning him. Now, you have to realize, we don't know what these people are expecting. We're not a radio show, it's a private conversation, you know, in
a way.
Don't get too upset. So anyways, he said...
Oh, no, that doesn't bother me in the slightest.
Right. So he says Scott's drowning and all that. So then, so he wanted to know who you were, so I told him about the 1999 thing. Well, he sent an email last night, I guess, or early this morning. Today. He said, I liked the two-hour 1999 interview Woods did with you. Helps explain Dobbstown to newbies. So he went back and listened to that, and he's doing his homework as much as he can, you know. So he's busy making films and stuff, but he fits it in. So he liked that interview. So that gave him a bit of background. So he says, he then sends me an URL, suck.com, and they're celebrating, we'd like to congratulate Jandek on the release of his 29th album in 23 years, Put My Dream on This Planet. Do you know who Jandek is?
Vaguely familiar. It's like experimental.
Yeah, he's a guy who doesn't leave his home. He's like totally, what's that word, agoraphobic or something, and he makes albums and one person hears it or something. But this is the magazine Suck.com, so they go for that kind of stuff. He says, it says, the album is close to an hour of our hero apparently mumbling into a dictaphone. for those unfamiliar with the Jandek phenomenon, he's a Texan. Then they go, well, musician, in quotes, is one way of putting it, who moans a sort of DSM-4, Vera Sleep. In other words, that psychiatric manual, a DS, multiple disorder, stage 4, Vera Sleep, usually while picking at a thoroughly non-tuned guitar, in the same sense that one picks at one's food. His uniquely painful and strangely addictive irv, all released by the otherwise non-existent Corwood label, is marked by an indistinct snapshot on every album cover. Leading Jandek scholar, that's rock criticism. Jandek scholar Seth Tissue. You ever heard of Seth Tissue?
No.
Okay. His note on the new disc artwork. Here's what he says about the artwork. I see a bent sleeved arm. If you can make out anything else, let me know. Says Jandek has never performed in public or consented to an interview. He's occasionally accused of perpetrating a dilettantish art project, but if you do something on a regular basis for over 2 decades, are you really a dilettante? In any case, Jandek deserves praise for his total non-interest in fame and willingness to hide behind his pseudonym. Of course, where reclusiveness goes, a camera cult surely follows, and the tribute album can't be far behind. One stalker has even posted photos of Jandek's P.O. box, the post office that contains it, and the Yellow Pages listing for Corwood. And since a web presence for the man himself is out of the question, somebody else has to set up a Corwood site consisting of a scanned copy of the mail order catalog. We suspect it's the only case of beneficent cyber squatting on record. All right, so then, look at, okay, that's the end of that topic, but the next sentence is, so much for the fearsome efficiency of Canadian justice. And then they go on something about Canadians and mafias, but isn't that funny? The Canadian thing, as we're talking. Okay, so he says, you need to process this. He said, here's a guy living out the realities you're scaring Scott Woods with. Now, I don't know what he's talking about, really. You know, I don't know what he meant. He says, here's a guy living out, but this is somebody who's listening to us and thinking about, I guess, as much as he can, living out the realities you're scaring Scott Woods with. You have to speak to the life, as a Scott-esque critic, okay, via Jandek. So you have to speak to the life as a Scott-esque critic, I mean, the life of being a rock critic. I'm not sure he's not grammatically saying this right.
Right.
You have to speak to something in relation to you via Jandek, which ain't, that's interesting, you know.
It's like he's pitting me as like the straight man kind of thing, like, and you're laying all this stuff on me. And, you know, he thinks I'm freaking out about it or something.
Yeah.
Someone like Jandek, he's saying, you know, here's a guy who's kind of living out what you guys are talking about, all this meltdown. I don't know.
Avoiding media exposure or something.
Yeah, not just sticking to, like, you know, being a rock musician.
Right.
Say, or something.
He's just mumbling. Okay. Now, here's the thing about Terry. He listens to James on My Cash Flow. He listens to Scott
right.
of the Fat Community. He listens to Ben. He listens to you. He listens to Mike Dyer. He loves Mike Dyer. And he listens to Greg Duffel on when I'm on International Connection up till it got
right.
stopped. Okay. He critiques every one of you guys. He's like, well, Scott does this, but he's fucked up on that angle. Ben's Scott Norris. And then Ben is this, but he's fucked up there. Greg is a basket case, blah, blah, blah. And James is an idiot, blah, blah, blah. So he critiques everybody.
And I
keep saying, you know, it's just ridiculous. It's very interesting to me to hear your personal projections, but we're not talking about, I don't give a fuck what you think of these people. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. And he says, yeah, well, I know, but I know that you're playing them off against each other, and it's a whole theater that you're creating, and you're showing all these different people that you react with and all that. And I said, yeah, that's partly true, but you don't know these people. I know them. You don't, and it's amazing how you project your psychological insight into the tones of voice or something, you know what I mean? So
right.
It's almost like I make fun of him that he does that, and I say, get back on just talking about ideas, not you analyzing the goddamn host. But that's all he is. He's like a director analyzing potential actors for his movie, you know, which one could do this, which one could do that.
Yeah.
And then
it's a fascinating thing. I mean, I have to admit, I'm always kind of, you know, when I'm always sort of, I talk to Dave about this, like, I've, you know, I'll tell him what I think about, you know, James Martinez as opposed to Ben, as
right.
opposed to Ion, as opposed to Greg.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, I just think, but it's kind of an interesting thing in and of itself, because it's like, what sort of, you know, how does everyone sort of react to you? And it's you learn something kind of from,
yeah.
you know, seeing that. And I mean, I admit with what that guy said that, you know, there's times when, yeah, I'm fucking drowning or I'm floundering. I'm just kind of like, but for me, it's like, I have no problem openly admitting that. I have to sometimes, like, listen back to this stuff the next day or for the next couple days to just, like, really start to absorb it. Like, I'm kind of absorbing it while you're saying it, but I can't dialogue with you on that level, and that's fine. I mean, I'm just, you know, trying to lead you kind of, you know, in some directions that I'm interested in. And,
yeah,
you know,
I think it's perfect.
Whatever.
You bring up a whole bunch of stuff that I never had brought out of me or questioned about. I mean, and you didn't know that I was had read these guys and was interested in them and talked
exactly,
to some
yeah.
of them. That's really good. I've always wanted to comment on them in this kind
yeah.
of format. And the so Neufeld, how did he respond to what you were saying?
Well, the funny thing is we talked about it, but he never actually told me whether he listened to the show that you and I have done or the shows that you and I have done.
He's probably busy.
For some reason, I just didn't come out and ask him, but he probably would have said if he had, and he probably would have given his
yeah.
thoughts about it. But no, I mean, we just had a general chat. I was actually at his place yesterday. We probably talked about you for about an hour or something.
Yeah, well, Dave likes talking about me because
he does
a fantastic imitation of him. Me, he and Bob Marshall are incredible, and they do me. It's hilarious. You know what I mean? Have you ever seen him do it? Did he do it for you?
Oh yeah, yeah. I know he's always like putting on your voice and stuff.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
like when Dave will have a phone conversation with me and he'll say, Bob says.
That's right.
It's so, like you admonishing him kind of thing, like, well, Dave, don't, you know.
Yeah, he'll repeat my admonishments. Dave, that's all content, Dave.
Yeah.
you're just making musical content, Dave. It's just an anesthetic, a drug.
Yeah.
The important stuff is the liner notes to Bob calls you, not anything you made. Yeah, he's good at parroting that back.
So, no, we're talking, you know, I was telling him about, you know, just I was giving him sort of my impressions of the Ben show, and we were both sort of talking about Ion a bit. He's probably listened to a bit more of the Ion stuff than I have, or maybe he's just grasping it a little quicker.
Yeah.
I think I was talking, the Ben show, you know, we both kind of thought it was interesting how you're coming up against this, like, I mean, it's interesting that guy's reaction, how he just does not like Ben, and he sees him as some sort of stuffy Brit or whatever. And
yeah.
That partly is true, but I think I told Dave, you know, that I think Ben is actually really sort of playing off you in an interesting way that I've never heard on any of your stuff before. So I love
that's right.
I mean, I told you right from the start, like, it was the Bob and Ben show that really kind of got me, you know, back into this stuff again. Like, I was like, when I first heard a few of those shows, I was like, oh, fuck, this is amazing. Like,
yeah.
And I love that Ben is, like, playing that kind of, like, oh, come off it, Bob. Like come down to earth.
Yeah. Come down and get on the revolution.
Yeah, but it, like, it there's a certain, I don't know. I mean, you do sort of speak to Ben differently than other people, and I guess it's because, you know, maybe, you know, I guess in order to keep the conversation going with him, maybe. Like,
yeah.
I can sort of hear what he's saying, you know. If you kind of don't, who knows, he could cut it off sort of thing. It was interesting the thing he did with it when you guys had Ion on, actually.
Oh, yeah.
That was actually a little brutal to listen to in some ways. I listened to it the first time, and then I think I listened a few weeks after.
Yeah.
And I honestly couldn't make it through the second time. I thought, oh, man, this is just like, Ben is just like, he just doesn't want anything to do with it, and it's just kind of brutal. Like,
yeah, well, but that's okay. Ion, I thought, handled it pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, Scott, are you, have you ever encountered anyone who channels stuff before Ion?
Never. Well,
so,
I mean, you know, except I've known of Bob's, you know, I've read Bob's Zappa interview, and I've heard some other stuff on the radio with Bob. Like, I think he did
the Evergreen, which I used to call the
yeah.
Exit.
Right. Yeah, with Bob and Wayne or something, I think.
Yeah, I used to play a lot of Evergreens when Wayne was on, after
but
Mike
no,
left.
But to answer your question, Scott, no. I mean, I've never, you know, it's obviously something I've heard of before, but I've had no prior sort of encounter with that kind of thing. So.
I had been sort of circulating around the channeling circuit in the 1980s, and I found a channel that I thought was authentic, and so I became open to the subject. So when Bob introduced Ion,
Scott, you knew about the Evergreens,
right?
First.
Bob introduced the Evergreens, and I wasn't offended by it because I was already familiar with the phenomena. And I had a private conversation with Ion shortly after Bob started channeling, or Bob started interacting with Ion, and I got kind of pissed off because I thought Ion was not accurate with some personal insights that I was asking him about. You know, I figure I'm the best person to judge whether or not somebody's accurate about me, and I thought Ion was a little bit off. But then Ion started winning me over. I don't know if that's because I was just simply testing him to begin with, and therefore, because I was being a little bit suspicious, I was distorting him, or if because Bob, after working with him for several months, started asking questions, which started bringing through Ion more clearly. And also I started then beginning noticing a pattern of consistency behind things that Ion was saying that seemed interesting to me. But
you started to hear him on the radio where he's doing topical, like, and that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I've been more impressed with him on the radio recently. I wasn't that impressed initially. I was curious, Scott, because you were not familiar with the phenomena, that you sounds like you stayed open to it in spite of the fact that it all seems pretty wacky to somebody who's never been involved with channeling before.
Yeah, well, I know. I mean, look, I'm definitely like open. I mean, I'm kind of open to anything in that way. And I mean, you know, Dave probably used to talk to me a lot about the Evergreens and stuff, so he kind of warmed me up to the idea. And that actually, and funnily enough, I actually have a sort of this very eccentric uncle, and his name is Michael Blake. But anyway, the Ion thing, one thing Ben said, that, see, Ben does have some things that are very similar to me, and I guess it's maybe that, you know, it is that kind of writing sort of background thing or something. But one thing I thought Ben said that really resonated with me was, I think in one of your shows, you know, you guys brought up the Zappa interview.
Mm.
And Ben sort of did a, you know, he sort of cut it, like interjected a little bit, saying, well, just so people understand, you know, it's kind of funny a little bit, just so everyone understands, you know, Bob claims to have, you know, interviewed Frank Zappa posthumously or whatever.
Yeah.
And although I'm not, you know, completely sure like how I feel about it, I just like I like the stuff that he got, you know, he's claiming to get from it, regardless of, you know, whether it's true or it's accurate or verifiable or anything of that. I thought, yeah, well, that in some ways for me, that's kind of the point too. It's like, look, if it's good shit, it's good shit. And it's,
yeah,
like,
Ben said, if I don't care what the source is, there were always great ideas in those interviews that Bob did with something called the Evergreens, you know.
Yeah,
that he said, and that's a good way to do it. But he wouldn't do it with Ion.
Yeah, it's interesting.
He really.
The one thing with Ion is that the suiciding idea. Dave and I talked about that a little bit. Yes, that you know, I'm still kind of.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing. But see, that's when Ion's bringing in a new level. You may never agree with it, but he has to one up all the psychics and all the stuff that's come before, and no psychic has ever said that. And he's not even a psychic. He's claiming to be where we go. It's the guff. It's even more incredible what Ion's claiming to be.
Right.
And from that view, every death's a suicide. And, you know, I've had to think about it ever since we started on March 18th. And that's the big meme. That's what, you know, separates the fans and the naysayers.
I've heard from so-called spiritual teachers that the soul, as it were, does not leave the body until it's accomplished whatever it was that it set out to accomplish when it incarnated. And when it has, then it, you know, it can...
It decides to leave, and then
it decides to leave. Yeah, so it's not a new idea for me, but the idea, but calling it a suicide is a little bit harsh. because of the fact that people die in such cruel ways, ways in which people, in which a conscious human being would never wish for. People being tortured to death, you know. I mean, nobody would wish for that. And yet, Ion's a little bit, in my opinion, cavalier, saying that, well, no, that's what they wanted, and that was the next logical step for them. And that was the way to their bliss. Well, I don't know about that.
The bliss of the afterlife, because Ion says that everybody's equal when they transition. They all have the same bliss of eternity, and they're just floating there, and Ion is, and Scott
no,
has heard...
No, but I'm not sure about that. I want to talk to you...
Yeah, we'll do that
when
later.
When we have time about that.
Scott has heard the three sessions that Ion did, and we offer for sale on what happens after you transition. So, but if you accept that Ion says everybody's floating in this bliss, and that's a larger experience than this place, though Ion's all for coming here, because the blandness of the bliss make souls want to come back. If you always are going to get bliss, once you're there, oh, it feels good. But when you're alive, you think it's painful. But it's almost like the soul knows, oh, I'm going to bliss. So it might be painful at my exit. I get tortured, but at least I'll get out of here and I'll be back to bliss. But Ion's revolutionary new idea is, hey, you don't need to go to the death plane to experience bliss. You can stay here and be immortal and have contact with the non-physical. Now, that's a talk about utopian vision. That's the highest utopian vision. You don't have to die and experience the bliss when you transition. You can do it here. That's what we're talking about. Now, who's going to believe that? So not many people, but we're in it for the long haul. And I will be the first example of it.
I love his expressions.
Yes, yes.
He's got a great accent and stuff, and you know, and he calls things isn't that delicious?
Yes.
You imagine a Truman Capote or
something. Yeah, what wonderful, what marvelous creators you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Now the thing is what the other incredible stuff is that when if and when a book comes out and you'll see his last name, who he is another mind blower. There are people who know him. Who don't know he's doing this, when they find out that it's him, that's a whole other level. So
really?
You can wait for that thing. And I'm not fooling you. Who he is incredible. Okay, so Ben blocked on it, which was okay, and he did that. But that's, it's like Scott blocked on a little bit at the beginning. But Ben doesn't wait around to find out. He just blocks. But hey, something could come up with Ion if he engaged it, just if he had time. Just like Scott kept engaging it, Scott Norris, and then he had a bit of a breakthrough with it. See, that's the thing. I'm always patient, because I never know where the next breakthrough's coming from, and you never know who it's going to be. So I'll hang around for everybody, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. Huh.
So then he says, you have to speak to the life as a Scottish critic via Zhandek. Then he says, looking forward to a mini Bob-esque ESQUE, looking forward to a mini Bob-esque rant or treatise on an upcoming episode. I think he means with Scott.
Right,
and then he says, is this the show's first fan mail? So he's saying that he's our first fan mail.
It's fan, yeah.
So, Terry's reaction, Jim Patterson reactions, Ben's reaction, Scott's reaction, and I don't think there's anybody else that I know.
Scott who?
You.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't think there's... Fialka hasn't heard any... Steve Reimer, the guy who did the timeline, he loves it. He likes...
Oh, cool.
But he likes anything, you know, so he's sort of a non-discriminating appreciator. He likes the Bob and Ben, he likes the Scott stuff. Oh, Monsquaz, this kid who Scott has talked to, Woods Norris has talked to, I talked to him yesterday, Scott, and...
he does your website, doesn't he, or something? Or
no,
he's on there a lot or something.
He's a great... He's a kid at the Rochester Tech College and for the last year or two, but he's not there this year. But he's about 22, And when we first started Five Bodied, pretty quickly he started summarizing my stuff because he actually did his homework, and he was a student at college, so he had that kind of mind. He read LaRouche, he read everything, and he went through the Fatic book, and then he did his own research, and he would always explain, answer questions to people. Now, those posts are long lost, you know, way back there and page 60 or something. But he hasn't been posting that much, but and because no one's really prompting him, but he did something the other day. And he also was the guy taping the shows and when there were, no one else was. So he's well appreciated on Five Bodies, and Scott's talked to him and likes him. He's pretty good at computer stuff. So Matt Shepard of Five Bodied Sleeper, the guy, it's his server, he gave him the keys to play around and create new inventories or whatever with the Bob stuff. So, but he hasn't had time to do it. So he's kind of bored with it. Like, he was a great Zappa fan when he was a kid, but he doesn't listen to Frank anymore. He's watched the idiots on Five Bodied and Alt Slack, and he thinks they're not smart enough to actually learn something from Bob, which is what he did. At least he used some of my stuff in his college papers, but he's been rather blasé. I don't know what he thought of. Okay, so he bought an Ion session on riff writing, and he had an interesting response to that, but that's personal. So he keeps up, but he said the Scott Wood stuff is pretty good, Bob. It's interesting. You know, it's a new angle, and that's what anybody who's looked into my stuff and then is looking for new stuff, they would, if they're a good student, so to speak, say that. They'd say, this is new. And it is new, because we've never heard you talk about this stuff.
You haven't done it, yeah.
Yeah. So
I always think what you're doing is the best stuff, and I think the Scott Woods stuff is the best stuff. I like the Bob and Ben for a different, I appreciate that for a completely different reason.
Yeah, you're hearing an intellectual there, a literary intellectual interact with Bob. That's what's unique about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he knows a lot of this. He's fast with ideas, so I'm not going to bowl him over with my ideas or my speed of references or something. He can keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, he's got a good mind.
But one of the things about you, Bob, is that people who try to bring you down and ground you into, you know, what we all, you know, our common concerns. I think Scott Woods is doing that to some degree. He's challenging, you know, you'll say stuff that seems, that leaves out the personal, and Scott Woods will...
Well, that's what rock criticism is. It's a personal, private concern response to the thing. So, yeah, that's why we're... I mean, I think, Scott Norris liked that I was going into particulars. Well, dealing with the personal brings out those kind of particulars.
Mm-hmm.
So rock criticism as a subject is bringing that out, right, Scott? Woods?
Yeah, I think so.
It's
yeah.
the personal thing, which I never had a chance to talk about. Now, what were we just saying? So Mon Squaz liked it, and this is the latest best stuff. But it's unique because it is moving more into the personal. It's like personal consumption.
But is that the point that you're making, Scott? That I'm a bit confused because I think you two are talking past each other a little bit there.
Mm-hmm. So what's your question, Scott?
Well, what was the point you were just making about?
Scott, you have. You relate personally to music and to rock and roll and to rock criticism.
Right.
And so you're asking Bob to address your private concerns, which we all share, but we're not all articulate enough to address the topics of rock criticism as you are, because it's been your bailiwick. So I think, to some degree, Bob Dobbs talks about collective issues that are of concern to us on a collective level, and confer new perception of how to perceive the collective in a way so not to get trapped by trapped by it. But you and Ben, you have your well, Bob. What about let's bring this down to brass tacks and that's what I like.
Yeah, you got Ben wants me. Well, Bob, are you going to come out and support the latest strike? You know, that's the Ben level. It's like he's a lofty intellectual trying to get me on the street, whereas Scott Woods is a guy coming up from the street and the street music and heading towards a lofty meaning from it.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? It's the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So this is so Terry, I remember him saying after the last, you know, either three, we've done four, this will be the fifth?
This will be five, yeah.
Yeah. After three or four, he said, Bob, you're just wiping him out. The guy is grasping for meaning in his raw criticism. He wants what he finds meaningful in his life. You're destroying everything that he finds valuable. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's how he's reacting. And his reaction is interesting. It's interesting somebody's thinking that's what's going on, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what he's doing is exaggerating the fact that he thinks that you live by rock criticism, that
yeah,
you believe in all stuff, and you probably don't.
No. I mean, he's kind of suggesting that you're shattering my world or something. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, you're the effect of what you're saying about some of this stuff. Probably, there are probably some people who will listen to this who would find it like a bit earth-shattering or just shattering in general kind of thing. Either that or they say, oh, I can't handle this, and just like turn it off sort of thing.
Yeah.
And which is another form of just finding it, you know, literally shattering or whatever, like I can't take it kind of thing.
Right.
But no, I mean, I mean, you know, I still sort of come up against, you know, some stuff you say once in a while, and I'm like, okay, well, come on, Bob, that's, you know, you're kind of cutting these guys down to size, and I'm not totally on side with you on that angle. But I want to, like, I want you to keep kind of going at it because I want to hear why. Like, it doesn't hurt me personally. Like, if you say Greil Marcus is full of shit or something, it's like I'm not friends with Greil Marcus, and even if I was, it's like, you know what I mean? It's like these are critics we're talking about. That's what we do. It's like,
yeah,
you know,
it's like Terry. In a way, I'm hearing Terry's world fall apart. You know, as he's interpreting, he's projecting his emotions on other people and saying they're falling apart, but he's falling apart. Like, he says to me, "Okay, now, Bob, I want to bring up this notion, but you know, you'll probably destroy it. But just bear with me. Let me bring it up. Okay, I want to talk about this. You know, so he's projecting his own tension with me."
Yeah.
Isn't that
in the first episode, I definitely, you know, the first episode, I was probably like, oh, come on, Bob, how could you say that?
Yeah. So what were you going to say, Wood and Norris?
Well, it's the last gasp of private identity. In order to maintain a private identity, I have to criticize you and other people in order to distinguish myself from you and other people.
Yeah.
And
the thing is, even Ion jokes about it. He says, Bob, don't worry what people think. You lost credibility decades ago. You'll make fun like that, you know? And that's true on a lot of levels. So, you know, I'm talking to people, like, if Terry thinks Scott is worried, Scott Woods is worried about his role as a rock critic or something, and Scott made a mistake even to talk to me.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
I mean?
and that's
because of my reputation, just engaging with me, because you're talking to a homeless person, so to speak. You know what I mean? You bring a homeless person in to talk nonsense, like Zandek. The thing is, I'm saying that I don't give a fuck what people think about me, and I don't think anybody else does now, because it's also fragmented media. So Terry's wrong to think that you're worried about that. And if you're not getting what I'm talking about, I'm willing to work it out and keep going. And if you sounded, you know, weak or something in the first few, so what? At least you stayed in there, and who knows what will happen by the 10th show.
Exactly. Well, and this whole thing for me personally is actually happening at a really interesting time because, like, I am, I'm at a point in my life where I am just completely, I mean, it's not your knowledge that's shattering me. It's my sort of disillusionment with, you know, the idea of even being a writer. And that's something that's been building up and growing inside of me for a long time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, you know, and I'm fed up with rock critics that I've tried to communicate with and stuff. I mean, I've got a couple of friends who sort of do it or whatever, but it's like, I'm sick of the bullshit. I'm sick of the game. I don't even really want to continue, like, the actual rockcritics.com site for that long. Like, I want to keep the archives up and all that. But it's like, so yeah, part of me, after that first episode, I did the next day, I was thinking, oh, God, if some people, like, listen to that, you know. Like, if some of that gets around to, like, Grill Marcus or Chris Gow or something, because they've been on the site. They've read some of, you know, I've interviewed those guys. I've conversed with them a little bit.
Are you considered a colleague? Are you considered a colleague?
No, not really. But, I mean, Grill Marcus was great to deal with. Like, we did, like, a sort of a round table thing with him. And, you know, he used to actually write me and say, oh, you know, I really like that interview on the site and stuff. So, whatever. So, he's familiar with me. He did like some stuff we'd done on the site. But, I mean, I was thinking the next day, I was like, oh, God, if some of this gets to some of these guys, like, any credibility I have, like, built up over the last, like, 10 years of this website is, like, you know. But then I thought, you know what, though? I don't give a shit because I don't have any fucking credibility anyway.
And nobody's
going to. And I don't, like, what, like, I'm not making a living at this stuff. I'm not trying to, and I'm kind of fed up with it anyway, but I still, like it enough as an intellectual sort of, you know, identity thing that I want to keep exploring, but I'm not...
No community has come out of it for you.
That's exactly what it is. I'm not part of any rock critic community. I was for a brief time in the 90s through some fanzines, but, you know, I'm more disillusioned than anything by that. So I'm happy to engage with... I just interviewed a writer a couple days ago who's, like, 24 years old, and, you know, the guy's really smart. He's, you know... Very, he just got a completely sort of different perspective and angle on the stuff than I do, and I always liked his writing. So I said, fuck it, I'm going to give the guy, you know, say, hey, I want to do an interview with you. So, I mean, it's sort of producing an interesting shift in me. Like, I am trying to sort of get a bit out of the writing thing. And
right.
I just want to talk to people about this stuff.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing. That's all I ever did. I mean, people say, Carolyn going on with Ion, that's going to ruin her credibility. Carolyn says, what fucking credibility? They took my license away 20 years ago. Everybody's worrying about martial law. They did that a long time ago, but I've overcome that. It's not even an issue. Like, Carolyn understands it's a post-information society. There is no fucking credibility. Look at Tiger Woods, the fucking king of the world, and they smear him if they want to. He's gone, his image. No one can survive the Android meme. So once you know that, there's nothing to worry about. I don't live by my TV image or body.
And I would actually love it if I ever got word through some or something like, oh, Chris Gow heard your interviews and thinks you guys are full of shit or something. Then I'd almost use that as like, well, that's an opportunity. Then, you know, I'm going to send him some of the good stuff. Then, like, I'm going to make sure he hears some of the good stuff.
Yeah, if he makes a passing remark, says, oh, you heard something. Well, how about all this?
Yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, and so I don't like I have nothing to kind of, you know, but. 6-7 years ago, this could have actually fucked me up a little bit, like psychically. I mean, you know what I mean? Seriously,
yeah, because
would, like,
you believed you were looking
for something.
You were looking for a rock community. You thought, well, I'll work my way up the food chain and then arrive someplace. Well, everybody finds out in our society. McLuhan even wrote about it that the specialist or scientist gets to the top and finds there's nobody there, and that's the group.
So imagine that, like, you know, 6-7 years ago, I had done this and posted on the site, then I'd be like, you'd have never heard from me again.
That's right. But you didn't, so you're doing it at the right time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm coming in at the end and sort of looking back at the 40 years and say, well, I'm marking everybody. You did pretty good there, but not too good over there.
Yeah.
But, you know, Professor Bob walks in to mark the papers that no one knew they were in a global classroom being tested.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay,
well,
so
Scott, I never got clear as to what you talked to Bob like 10 years ago, and apparently it created a sense of disillusionment. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I don't want to overstate that, but I think I can't remember exactly the feelings, but I remember I was talking to Dave Neufeld about it, and I remember just after interviewing Bob, and it wasn't immediate. It was almost like, you know, something like, I don't know, 2-3 days later, and the more it kind of was sinking in. You know, it was probably a thing that, fuck, I've kind of been placing sort of kind of all my cards on this one table, and like, you know what I mean? And now Bob kind of came and sort of, you know, blew the card house down
yeah.
a little bit. So it wasn't, I mean, it didn't make me, you know.
In what sense did he blow the card house down?
No, I remember, well, if you look at it, it made you feel claustrophobic, like there was no, I said, everything's obsolete, you're paralyzed. And that's not a good thing to do to somebody, but my stuff can do that at a first introduction. You think that's what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean,
I remember you saying that. It was like, where do we go? There's no, that's what the thing
that's
is
what it was,
wrong.
Yeah.
Nowhere
what,
to run. That's what the interview
that's what it was.
Yeah, nowhere to run.
And part of it was that was the first time ever, because I mean it's weird because I had listened to you for many years before
yeah,
then.
Yeah.
So, and you know here I was kind of you know getting all my questions prepared and all that stuff and you know I mean I think like you know it was a good conversation had some good questions and stuff but it wasn't like I guess I wasn't just fully prepared like. You know, well, how do I follow up then when you just, you know, say something like that?
Yeah.
It was like, I do remember one moment I was, like, looking at my sort of next questions, and I was like, I don't really know where to go from here. And I remember you even kind of cut in and said, well, just ask me what you've got written down. Who cares what it is kind of thing. I'm like, oh, okay. Because I remember, like, I was looking ahead thinking,
yeah.
But wait a second, Bob's already kind of like, stepped all over this stuff, like, so, you know, now, how am I going to ask this now and it's not going to sound fucking ridiculous or something? You know, I was probably kind of self-conscious about it.
Yeah, that's a young mind. That's what young people are. They're looking for an identity. They have to save the identity they think they got, and they're fucking fanatics. McLuhan said in a tribal society, you have flexible elders and rigid youth, and that's true. You know, the whole counterculture, or rock industry, you know, the kids are wild and the parents are conservative, stick in the mud. It's actually opposite, because you're becoming a father now. Well, you start having your kids, and then all the stuff you got to deal with, and you actually are doing a lot of different activities. Your kid's just going to school, and your kid's saying, "You know, Dad, you're a fucking stick in the mud," and your father's doing five different things, or you as a father.
Yeah,
you know, it's an important insight. Kids aren't going to get it. Flexible elders and rigid youth.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, just that. The point is, I've got a whole bunch of, quote, ammunition and thoughts that are good thoughts that no one's ever heard before. So everybody gets stunned by whenever I show up or say anything. Well, that's interesting. Well, I don't know what to think about. I haven't thought about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's a very common reaction.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got the best ammunition.
And I do definitely want to get this stuff to some critics. I mean, I guess I probably want to, like, almost package it in such a way that it's like, you know, well, it's almost like I would have to almost explain to some people if they listen to the first episode, like, well, don't, you know, you got to listen past where he's saying, you know,
yeah.
Chris Gow and Marcus don't know what they're talking about. Like I said, like, got to listen past that. Like,
yeah, because I don't say they don't know. I say they leave out the opportunities to bring in new knowledge in their field. Since they have an audience every week or whenever they write their columns, stick some of these powerful ammunitions in there.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, we live in a society, remember McLuhan, nobody listened to him. I talked to McLuhan through the Evergreens or something representing McLuhan, and he said that he was damn fucking tired of explaining the difference between visual space and acoustic space, which he'd been doing since the early 50s, and, you know, by 25 years later, and he said, it's just, I said, fuck it, I'm checking out. I'm on to kinetic and tactile and a whole bunch of advanced stuff, and people are still asking me about what is the letter A, and how is that different from the letter B, and he's working with the whole alphabet and writing paragraphs, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what happens anyway. As a matter of fact, Ian was telling me, a couple sessions ago, he said McLuhan wrote for the future and knew it. He didn't get upset that he wasn't understood, in a way. He knew that he was writing for the future. And then I've got a whole new bunch of stuff on McLuhan from Ion, which may just be Ion's perspective, but I don't know. It just could be that I can take the new level now, because Ion is a level past the Evergreens.
Yeah, yeah.
So
you posted something on the, or somebody posted, maybe it was Michael Edmonds posted something on McLuhan's site, McLuhan web server, that was a two-page JPEG of a letter that
Jim
wrote.
Did that. Jim Patterson, he takes pictures of the, that's from the Book of Letters, and it's a 1962 little manifesto by McLuhan about TV, Our Conqueror.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that was the most definitive thing I've ever read on the subject.
And that was written before Gutenberg, Galaxy, and Understand Media.
Yeah.
And he could have written that 5 years before.
Yeah.
Probably did.
No, I really got a new comprehensive understanding about what he meant by the tactility of the television.
You see, that's why I have a mastery of McLuhan, because I read that stuff 30 years ago, and you would learn from it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And if you read it and look at it, you say, oh, wow, I see what he's saying, then you know that. See, now you know something, Scott, to work with.
Right.
Hey, Bob, I got the Thiel book out of the library.
That's great.
It's kind of hard to actually get that book now. Eventually I'll order it, but it's a little more pricey, and they don't carry it in the store. You actually have to order it if you get it through Chapters or something.
Right.
But so I looked it up in the library. It was there, the virtual McLuhan. I just picked it up today, actually. It looks great. But I noticed who's the first person mentioned in the book?
Of course.
Robert Dobbs.
That's right. I caused that book. I'll tell you.
That's what he says. He does say that.
Basically. Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you. There's a whole interesting thing between me and Thiel. Because he was the best student of McLuhan, his first PhD. And Thiel was left alone after McLuhan was gone. He had no one to talk to until he met me.
Wow.
Okay, so that's a whole other topic. Now, you go another hour?
It's kind of pushing it, but I know I was just thinking about that. Got the time, you know, we're eating up all this time.
Oh, yeah. It's
fun chatting.
But it's good. No, this is a good interval. We need to have to work this out a bit. So
let's do it. I'd like to try and shoot for 1 o'clock, but if it goes 15 minutes past that, I can live with it.
So we can at least get 40.
I just got a really busy schedule these days, so it's been a bit harder to keep up. So.
I wonder if we should forget about that this week. We can do 40 minutes, and you feel lost. You're not sure where to go. You're not prepared. So maybe we should not do one this week.
Maybe. Or is there another night? Scott Norris, you can only do this certain night, right?
Monday and Sunday. And I can't do next Monday, but we could do Sunday. But didn't one of you guys say you couldn't do Sunday?
Yeah, that was me.
So we might not do one for another week. So, well, we better do 40 minutes.
Yeah, let's start one. If it goes a bit past, it's fine.
Maximum hour.
Yeah, that sounds good. And even if we're like kind of mid thought, we'll almost maybe cut it off, sort of like the Bob. That'll be my job. I'll almost cut it off like the Bob and Ben show or something. And I'll give you the 1 minute warning sort of thing.
Yeah, and we've got 4 or 5 people who are addicted to us, so they need their hit this week. So we better do something for them.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So I've got on a roll on my bar. I've got all the pages that you sent me. So didn't you want to go through those?
We could continue to go through those. I thought there was two things. There's three different angles. I thought we could continue to go through those to keep it sequential. Or
with the text. See that?
I agree. I agree. The only other thing I thought to maybe change it up a bit is if you wanted to maybe start to shift over a little bit to the Bang stuff. But we could continue.
Yeah, no, that's what we can go. We can do some Bang stuff.
Why don't we do that? I'm even just thinking. There's one article in particular that I sent you that I've kind of highlighted some good quotes.
Okay, which is that?
The Richard Hell one.
Okay, I got that right here. I'll bring that up.
Death means never having to say you're incomplete.
Yeah, well, that's relevant since I can't bring in really the Ion stuff, but we can talk about secular death and what it means because, I mean, Ben told me not to bring in the Ion stuff. But then one day I brought it in, and he created an alibi. He said, well, this is all wacky stuff. But, when you read the interviews, it's interesting. So the ideas are good regardless of the source. That was his alibi for letting me go in, citing IAM, but he doesn't want it brought up too much.
Right, right.
Okay, so I'm getting the article. Let's see.
What was the other bang stuff I sent you?
I've got here Kraftwerk feature, Richard Helm,
talked about a little.
Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music.
Right.
Let's see, what else?
That might be it by Bangs, and then I sent you the stuff on that same web page where it's just there's a few references to Zappa kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd have to re-look at it, but here Kogan wrote a book, Why Music Sucks. That's an interesting topic, even though...
A fanzine, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's number 10, the Richard Hell, so I'll just get that. Okay, I've got it. So I'm going to look at that.
Okay. So let me.
Okay, I'm going to go sit up, just clear my throat, and then it's February. It's December 7th, right, Scott?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a second. I'm glad we had to talk because you were in a low period anyways. You're heading a malaise, so. We didn't start off this talk to address that, but it was good to get all this, whatever we've been talking about, out, right?
Yeah, definitely. Hey, Bob, could we, well, maybe not, because we have only 40 minutes, so forget it. No, it's okay. We'll go right into the bangs.
Yeah. I like doing this text. Whatever you want to go into is good.
Yeah, okay.
Ready.
Yeah, we ready to start taping?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.